Hello and welcome again to another edition of Lost in Science. This is half an hour on the audio device that you are listening to, where we're going to talk about some science. Who are we? Well, I am Stu, and on the show with me this week, I have Claire.
Hello, Stu.
Hi, Claire. And I have Chris.
Aloha.
Aloha. Aloha. Very, very topical. I don't know.
Actually,
have you been
to
Hawaii lately?
No, not really. We'll come back around to that later.
Okay. So hello and goodbye. But Claire, have you got a story for us this week on the show?
I do. I actually have an interview, a special guest on the show this week, Dr. Jess Marsh from the University of Adelaide. Jess is actually, when you think of the Nullarbor Plains, what do you think of?
No trees.
Jess studies something. Yeah, Nullarbor, yeah. No trees. Yeah. Jess studies something not on the plains themselves, but underneath the plains. I didn't know this, but there's like a massive amount of caves down there.
Still no trees though.
Still no trees. Yeah. So you're not wrong. Yeah. So Jess is going to tell us all about her research looking at the caves underneath the Nullarbor Plains and the weird and wonderful ecosystems that you can find down there, because they're like incredibly well specialized and adapted invertebrates that live in these caves. And as you can imagine, being in a cave, it's pretty dark, so you don't need eyes.
What do you call an invertebrate with no eyes?
Invertebrate.
I think that's
invertebrate.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll definitely chat about that and more.
Awesome. Well, I will have to listen to that and not use my eyes. But
yeah, it's Chris, perfect for us, isn't it?
Yeah, great. Great for radio, talking about eyeless creatures. Chris, what have you got for us this week?
Well, I've got something a little bit different. So, these kind of underground ecosystems, some people say that these kind of bizarre ecosystems, we know less about them than we know about outer space. But outer space is really, really big, can I just say. And however, there is a lot of stuff going on out there. And recently, you may have seen in the news, there was a object from outside our solar system seen spotted coming through our solar system, from another star system coming through our solar system. It's the third such object that's ever been seen. So I don't know whether we know a lot about these external solar system things, but you know, we've got a sample of three, so maybe we're learning something about them.
But so it's the third one, but in how long? What are we talking about in recorded history of objects from beyond the solar system?
The third one we've identified. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, okay. But and when, like, how long ago was the first one?
2017, Stu. So
Right. So we don't know that they're actually getting faster. We're just getting better at noticing.
Yeah, I mean, we're assuming there would have been other ones before then. And in fact, there could be some, you know, around us right now. You know, there could be.
That's creepy.
Yeah, it's creepy. I'll explain later.
Are the extra solar objects with us in the room now, Chris?
They could well be, Stu. They could well be.
All right, well, we'll have to find out what in outer space you are talking about, but we better do that. So on with the show.
Hello, yes, you're listening to Lost in Science, and I am talking about the third interstellar object seen entering our solar system, verified, I suppose, interstellar object entering our solar system. It's got the name of 3I/Atlas.
3I/Atlas.
The slash is pronounced. The slash is just a
really cool, okay. Does that mean it could be referred to as either 3I or Atlas?
Well, we should unpack the name. Probably normally, the atlas would be the part that people refer to these things by. Because so the 3I represents,
it's a good name.
The 3I represents third interstellar.
Right.
And then the other part, it's either the name of the object or who discovered it. And in this case, it was discovered by Atlas, who was not, as Stu might have guessed, from Astro Boy.
He was a scary dude from Astro Boy, a giant robot that was threatening everyone. Yes.
No. It is, it's NASA's Asteroid Terrestrial Impact Last Alert System.
Right.
Which is basically a telescope they've set up to, to look for threats, I suppose you could say. And it's based in South Africa, this particular one. And so the idea is, it looks for things that perhaps asteroids or things that may not have been spotted before. It spotted this object heading towards our solar system, basically. And so it is named after Atlas. Number two was, 2I was 2I Borisov. That was discovered in 2019. It was a comet that was found by someone called Borisov, as the name may suggest. But 1I has a more interesting name. You may have heard of it. It is 1I Oumuamua.
Oh, yeah, cool. we covered that on the show. We
talked about it quite a bit, and I apologize for butchering the Hawaiian pronunciation. It has one of those Hawaiian kind of, I don't know what you call it, where you kind of catch the in your throat of, sort of at the start of it. So it's sort of Oumuamua, but I can't really do it.
Right.
It's all in the accent, yeah.
It is. So apologies to the Hawaiians, but hence my aloha from earlier.
Uh-huh. It all makes sense now.
Yeah. So, we have talked about Oumuamua. It's been a while. What do you remember about Oumuamua, Stu?
I think I remember more about the random theories about how it was a spaceship because it sped up as it left the solar system and changed direction and all sorts of things, which made some people suggest things for which there was very little evidence, I think.
Yeah.
That's the main thing I remember about it.
That is the main thing, yeah. So it did accelerate as it was heading away from the sun. And this led an astronomer from Harvard, Avi Loeb, to declare that it was he believed it was a solar sail, like a hypothesized starship that is powered by sunlight, effectively by the power of sunlight pushing it away. And that was his explanation for why it was accelerating away from the sun. He's pretty confident about this. He's doing the rounds of basically trying to say this is the first, alien spacecraft that's been seen and verified, but no one else seems to think it's been verified. There are, of course, other more natural theories, and the solar sail system didn't make a lot of sense. So this object appeared to be long and thin, not kind of wide and flat, as you would expect with a solar sail. And it was seen to be tumbling in its motion, which would not be an ideal kind of configuration, you'd think, for a solar sail.
You want it to be a bit more stable than that to actually be able to direct it or... Yeah,
that's right. So the consensus seems to be that it's some sort of ice, basically a ice fragment. It was a bit mysterious because didn't appear to be a comet. Like a comet normally gives off a lot of gas and dust or, water vapor, this sort of stuff. And so it has that nice big glowing tail spreading out behind it. This one didn't appear to have any of that. So they're going, how can this, maybe it's an asteroid, but how is an asteroid that's not a comet accelerating? We can't see any obvious gas. So maybe it might have been some sort of gas that is less visible. So I think one of the latest theories is a paper published in 2023 in Nature that suggested that basically it's a chunk of water ice that's got hydrogen that has built up inside, a hydrogen gas due to the action of cosmic rays hitting it, has basically separated some of the hydrogen oxygen molecules from the water, and hydrogen gas is built up. And then when it gets heated by sunlight, the hydrogen kind of spits out and gave it a bit of a rocket boost. That's their idea, essentially. But, obviously the alien hypothesis was a bit more kind of compelling, I suppose. But it's interesting. I looked at some of what Avi Loeb had to say, and one of the interesting arguments was, what is the likelihood of a random piece of rock or ice wandering through our solar system like that? And he did some calculations that seemed to suggest that it was so unlikely that it had to have been deliberately sent here.
and do those calculations stand up?
Well, there's obviously a lot of interpretation and guesswork in the fact that we've seen a couple of others since then kind of suggests that maybe it is more common and some more cake.
Or maybe it suggests that there's three aliens that have come through.
Well, some more calculations have been done more recently, I suppose. We can look at that, actually, if we want. The first one was a bit more serious because, like I said, it wasn't have an obvious kind of comet tail. The second one, Borisov, definitely did have a tail. A tail is quite large, about 14 times the size of Earth, is what I have seen it described as. Yeah, and so it's from its makeup from the scene from the spectrum, it appears to be very similar to makeup to the comets from our solar system. The latest one, 3I Atlas, basically was discovered in the middle of June, 14th of June. At first, they couldn't see that it did have like an actual kind of atmosphere or kind of any sort of tail. But since I everything pointed their telescopes at it, people have seen this sort of gas around it, and it does look like it is an actual comet. It's still a fair way away, so the tail will probably grow bigger. I think it's currently about 25,000 kilometers long, which is about twice the size of Earth. So I presume it'll grow as it gets a bit closer to the sun.
What do you say the tail is made up of?
Well, the tail is just made out of like gas and dust and that sort of thing. I mean, if you've got a lot of the comets
just burning up as it goes.
Well, so yeah, a lot of the comets are made up of say water ice. And the ice basically kind of evaporates and blasts off as it comes through the solar system. And then kind of, yeah, you get these kind of ice crystals and water vapor and plus dust and things. Because they're dirty snowballs is where they're often pictured comets. So, yeah, it's kind of that ice and gas and dust and things trailing behind the comet. Yeah, so that's what we know about it so far. But yeah, so it does seem to be a bit of a comet, and these things can come from other solar systems. For instance, we know that our own solar system can eject comets, basically. There's been at least two comets that have been spat out from our solar system. There was one in 1980, which was...
So yeah. How do they know that the comets leaving our solar system? Like, where do they come from?
Well, what happens is they come from, these ones come from within our solar system. Basically, you track these things moving along, and you look at their trajectory, and you can work out from how fast they're going, the direction they're going, whether they're in an orbit that's going to take them, whether it's going to be a stable orbit that's going to turn around and get back around the sun again, or whether they're going too fast and they're likely to go outside. Solar system. So yeah, there was one scene in 1980 that basically got too close to Jupiter and got kind of launched off in outside of the solar system. And then there was one in 2024 that had the same thing happen with Saturn.
So basically the comets are accidentally doing the planetary slingshot thing that we've used to launch spacecraft further out.
Yeah, basically. Another way of looking at it is that the planets are basically flinging stuff out. The planets are clearing out the solar system, and anything gets too close, but they either hit the planet, these large planets, they'll either hit the planet or they'll fling them off out of the solar system, the slingshot maneuver, like you said. So, yeah, we've seen that happen from our solar system, so it can happen to other solar systems. There was a paper published recently in the Planetary Science Journal that tried to calculate for a close-by star. They looked at Alpha Centauri, which is one of the close star systems to Earth, about 4.4 light years away. And they tried to calculate how much material from Alpha Centauri could actually have reached our solar system. And so kind of in the outer Oort cloud, they call it, which is the cloud at the edge of the solar system where all the comets kind of hang out, they reckon there could be about a million particles larger than 100 meters in diameter that have come from the Alpha Centauri system that are hanging around our solar system at the moment. And that's fairly large ones, larger than 100 meters. And a smaller number, we talk about smaller ones, then they could, already be hitting Earth. They have estimated that maybe about 10 meteors, small meteors from Alpha Centauri could be striking Earth every year.
Every year?
Every year. It's a rough estimate. And so they basically, it's hard to know exactly how much is ejected from that star system, but basically looking at what our solar system does and extrapolating and say maybe it behaves similar. But so the fact that we know stuff gets fed out of our solar system, we can say, okay, let's look at a nearby one. How much stuff would come from there? And yeah, and that's what they've calculated.
So if it's 10 from, say, Alpha Centauri,
yeah,
it could be equivalent numbers from other stars, or is it going to drop down in frequency?
Yeah, the further you go out. And Alpha Centauri is getting closer to us at the moment. Mm. It's going to get its closest approach to the sun in about 28,000 years. And that's when we expect, a lot more of them. And it is very low probability they will actually come very close to Earth, the large ones. But yeah, the small ones are expected to. When I say small, we're talking something that's larger than about 100 micrometers. So that's what, 0.1 of a millimeter. So these are tiny meteors, but they could be space dust in your room right now, is what I'm saying, from Alpha Centauri, from another star system.
Amazing.
Yeah. So anyway, Three-Eye Atlas, like I said, it is from its trajectory, it is clearly going too fast to be from our solar system. It's come from outside. We don't know where it's come from yet. To give you an idea, it's going at about 245,000 kilometers per hour. And you need to be traveling at least 150,000 kilometers per hour to break out of our solar system. So it's going much faster than it needs to be to escape our solar system. So yeah, it's probably going to fly by the sun and then get out of here. Its closest approach to the sun will be in October this year. Its closest approach to Earth, which will be like hundreds of millions of kilometers away, will be in December this year. But, you know, hopefully we'll be able to see some sort of tail of the comet, we'll be able to put on a show for us as it goes past. But, I mean, we're never going to see it again because it's leaving for good. But, it's fascinating to me that there are so many of these things out there and that are coming by. But at least we're doing our bit and we're sending some comets their way as well, I suppose.
I think we're lost.
We're not lost.
Not even any short-range radio signals yet?
Except for a single, very powerful radio emission.
Of course, a transmitter of that sort isn't exactly standard equipment.
Science and technology must be absolutely mind-boggling.
Of course, that's mostly on the theoretical side.
What so far? Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
Have you ever wondered about what life exists in the caves deep underground? How have animals adapted and how does an ecosystem function when there is no light? Well, our guest today is investigating these very questions, Dr. Jess Marsh from the University of Adelaide, who works in invertebrate conservation biology and is part of a research group who have been exploring the caves underneath the Nullarbor Plains, finding all sorts of weird and wonderful invertebrates down there and some very strange features adapted perfectly for cave life. Jess, welcome to Lost in Science.
Thank you, and thanks for having me on today.
Now, tell us about your research in caves under the Nullarbor Plains. I had no idea there were caves there.
Yeah, it's been an amazing adventure so far. So the Nullarbor goes in Australian folklore as this big, vast, treeless plain that people, you know, there's stories about people crossing it and driving to get from South Australia to Western Australia. And so it's known as this big, vast, empty space. But underneath ground, there's this huge network of intricate caves and cave life that is globally important. So it's the largest continuous cave, limestone cave area in the world.
Wow.
And it's got some species and some animals living there that are just the only examples that we know of in the world of that type of animal. And it's a hugely important place that's hidden below ground.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine that would be a very good reason why you'd want to study it.
Yes. Yeah. So I work mainly on spiders. So I work on bugs generally, but spiders are my special thing. That's what I like. And I love adventure. I love caving. And there's something about being in a cave when you're in a world that is so alien to our day-to-day life. It's, you know, it's dark. It's rugged. It's like dusty. It's very different. And it's like a big adventure. And so combining spiders with caving for most people would probably be a bit scary, but for me it's my ideal dream.
I mean, that is absolutely incredible. I was going to say it is like, it's sort of the list of phobias, the top phobias that come to mind, written one after the other: scared of the dark, scared of spiders, scared of small like places.
Yeah, there's a lot of small spaces and there's a lot of very big heights. So it is the whole, it's got all of it. But it's such an adventure. And as a scientist, that's really, being able to go into these worlds to see things and to look at them, and to be able to witness and enjoy what's under there is a real privilege. But I could see why some people would be absolutely terrified.
Tell us what have you found on your adventures?
Yeah, so I was on the Nullarbor in April 2025, and we went to a cave that I'd heard stories about from cavers, that it has a lot of invertebrate, so spiders, cockroaches, centipedes, and I was prepared for the, being something quite cool because that's what I enjoy. When we went into this cave, we saw that there were thousands of invertebrate species just everywhere on rocks. And as I started looking at them moving through the cave, I realized that they were not only that there were a lot of species that I'd never seen before, so a lot of new species, but also a lot of them were really highly adapted to life in a cave. And so there were most of them, in fact, all of the specimens that I've examined so far have lost their eyes, so they've got no
Wow.
sight. They've got really long legs, and lots of sensory hairs, because if you're living in a dark world with no light and you've got no eyes, the main way that you're going to be finding your way around is through sense of touch and through chemical senses. It was like nothing I've seen before, and huge numbers of these specimens. The fact that they were all mummified and we didn't find any living ones is one of these mysteries that I'm hoping with research and some more tests to see if we can try and work out what happened. Some of the specimens that we saw, so there were some cockroaches, which were lots of cockroaches there, all eyeless. Some of them had died mid climbing up a wall on the cave, and they were so well preserved that they could have died yesterday. They looked like they were almost freeze-dried, frozen in life.
What does that tell you about the decomposition process in caves?
Yeah, and that's a really good question. So we know that caves preserve dead material, organic material, really well. They tend to be relatively stable conditions. You don't get much, you don't get light in there, and the humidity and the temperature means that they preserve well. This cave as well was really salty, which helps with that preservation. So we know that caves do preserve things well. These specimens, some of them from the position that they were sitting in relation to decorations and sorry, decorations meaning stalactites and stalagmites growth in the cave, formations in the cave, I think that they are likely to be quite old, but we don't know yet. So this is the great thing with science that I love, is that investigation. They could be tens of years old. That cockroach on the wall looks like it died yesterday, could be tens of years old. It could also be tens of thousands of years old. We don't know yet. And so this is like part of the puzzle that we're trying to dig into and to explore as a scientist. It's why I chose to do science, is for these sorts of puzzles. It's endlessly exciting.
I mean, it sounds incredibly surreal. And I just like thinking about it in my head, I just keep on wondering, like, what did the wider ecosystem sort of look like? Was it just these invertebrates, or, was it a, were there plants? Were there other, were there vertebrates as well? Or what did it look like when they were alive?
With this cave, it's unusual that we didn't find many vertebrate remains. So there's some possums that were mummified, and some colleagues are working on trying to get a date on those as well to see how old they are. But apart from that, we didn't find any vertebrate remains, no bones. And usually, when you're in a cave in the Nullarbor, you have to be very careful not to crunch through vertebrate bones, because they're quite, they're abundant, they're common. And so I don't know what's happened with this cave, why we don't have that vertebrate mass. There are some really intriguing insights and glimpses of what could be going on. So one of the passageways we were in, this was 80 meters below ground and quite far into the cave, we came across this rock, and on that rock were lots and lots of dead weevils, which are little beetles. these weevils, as much as we know of them, they live off plant roots. And there are other similar weevils in other caves that live off tree roots that come down into the surface to the roof of the cave. Now, these weevils were only found on this one rock in this one section of cave. The cave is a very big cave, so it's around 9 kilometers in length, and
Oh,
we found
wow.
in this one place. And above, in the ceiling above this rock where we found the weevils, were holes in the ceiling, which, and this is all very preliminary, and we need to test it, but they could have been made by tree roots. If these weevils were living on tree roots that came through the roof of the cave, this would date them back to a time when the Nullarbor was forested, which was pre-Australia drying up. And so that is an amazing insight into what life could have been like. We've
Yeah.
been talking about whether we can analyze what these weevils were eating, so we can see what species it was. If it was a tree, it may be. These are all unusual species that we're finding, so they could be doing something completely different. You know what I mean? They could be eating something weird, but all these little hints at what's going on, and kind of it's like being a detective trying to trace back what's happening. So we're sending the weevils off to get them carbon dated, which will give us an age for them. And so that is just one of the mysteries. And I think the potential for this cave telling us things about what life was like, you know, in the past is really it's exciting, I think.
It's so exciting, so much so I think you should put detective in your bio now.
Absolutely.
Invertebrate detective.
Yeah.
Just to finish up, what's next on your list? I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of different avenues that you can go down, so many questions. What's highest on your priority list?
No, that's a really good question. So, actually, probably the most exciting find from the cave I haven't mentioned yet. To paint you a picture, the cave is very difficult to get into. It's about 45 minutes of very tight squeezes, some quite scary drops, lots of crawling and wriggling on your stomach. And then it's 9 kilometres of cave in front of you, which is awesome, and a lot of wriggling and crawling in front of you. Anyway, so I'd been going through this cave. We're about 1.6 kilometers in, and you get used to seeing the spiders, the cockroaches, centipedes. It's like, yep, okay. And I saw this little thing sat on a rock. Again, it was dead and mummified. And when I went to see it, it was a wasp. As soon as I saw this wasp, I knew it was something different. It's like, what on earth would a wasp be doing? Quite a large wasp, about that big. What would it be doing that deep in a cave? And so I brought it out to the surface, had a look at it, and realized it didn't have any eyes. And it had very long legs, very long antennae, and was a really unusual looking wasp. It didn't look like a normal wasp. Its wings were tiny, suggesting it might be flightless. And I spoke to some scientist colleagues. It is the only known cave adapted wasp in the whole world. So
Wow.
this is a wasp that we think at one point lived on the surface, had eyes, normal species. And then as Australia dried up, it's likely that it got pushed down underground into the caves where it could survive, where the humidity is higher and where there's more shade, and it can survive the kind of temperature extremes that you get on the Nullarbor. Through evolution over a long period of time, it became eyeless, and it's now, to the form that we know it, is trapped in a cave. What is extra exciting about this wasp, and is exciting for me as somebody who works on spiders, is that the type of wasp it is one that parasitizes spiders, and they can be host specific. So we've got this story of this wasp that's gone from a surface species down into a cave living species. All of the spiders in the cave are similarly highly cave adapted, like eyeless, white, pale, long-legged things. And so two species going from surface eye species, getting pushed down into the cave and independently evolving along this kind of pathway into this really high level of cave adaptation linked through parasitism, I think is just like it's a story that needs to be told.
That those
Yeah.
relationships just repeat themselves in these incredibly difficult to live in
Yeah,
environments.
absolutely. Absolutely. And because this wasp is the only known cave adapted wasp in the world, that means there's so much for us to find out. You know what I mean? It's the story is new, and that means that pretty much everything we find out about its relationship to the host species, about there's a story to tell there too, and there's so much more pieces of this puzzle to kind of pull apart. But I think that is going to be my focus for a little while. That wasp is just, it's just so many questions surrounding it.
Obviously, this is an incredibly unique cave and an environment, and the biodiversity here is like nothing else in the rest of the world. What's being done to protect it or...
Yeah, well, unfortunately, with the nullarbor, we know that there are a number of key threats. One of the caves that I went into where we found living eyeless spiders had also a lot of fox scat, fox poo in there. And I've had the glorious task of searching through that fox poo to see if I can see what they're eating. And we have got some evidence that they may have been eating some of these cave living invertebrate species. So we know that, we think that feral animals might be a problem. The other thing that's a problem with the nullarbor and that is of concern is that it's currently not well appreciated for its biodiversity. This life is not well known. Certainly, we don't know where the caves are that contain this life. There's a lot that we need to find out. And all of the caves that I've visited on my most recent trip were in the footprint of a proposed large-scale development, which has the potential to be really harmful to the life in those caves. And I think it's important for us as humans to know what we're at risk of losing, and so we can make the decisions that are needed and really weigh up the cost. So the development is a green energy development. We need green energy. We really do. Climate change is a massive threat, but I think we also need to be able to weigh up the cost to biodiversity. To say as humans, we are aware that by putting this here, we're getting green energy, but we're also likely to result in the extinction of species. And I think that needs to be much more open. So I think that for me, it's one of the drivers is to at least make sure that that decision, that weighing up, is a really difficult decision.
Well, Jess, thank you so much for joining me on Lost in Science today. It's been what an absolutely fascinating to hear about your cave adventures, the scientific discoveries. It sounds like you're going to be making them, well into the future. So best of luck for the next expedition. Can't wait to hear more about the wasps. Please come back and talk to us again soon.
Thank you. It's been really great to talk to you, Claire.
And that is all we have time for this week on Lost in Science. Thank you for joining us in Getting Lost. If you have any questions or suggestions for the team, get in touch with us by email. We are lostinsci@gmail.com. You can send cheap tweets to us at lostinscience1 on Twitter, or you can find us on the ubiquitous Facebook. Lost in Science is recorded at the studios of 3CR in Melbourne on the land of the Kulin Nation and is broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find a podcast version of the show on 3cr.org.au, or you can tune in the way you did this week when we return in our usual time slot to get
Lost in Science!
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.